Well, hello, hello, guys. You're listening to Beauty Bites with Dr. K, Secrets of a Plastic Surgeon. And today's podcast is so interesting. We are all talking about peptides, IV drips, GLP-1s, and all the things we can do to next level our health and performance. I'm going to interview today Jason Pensek. He's a chiropractor and a nurse practitioner. He started working in medicine as a registered nurse in 2010, and he quickly realized that Western medicine had failed many people. He went back to school to study for chiropractic and then decided he wanted even more than that. So really intensified his learning and training in terms of IV therapies and peptides. And now he has been trained and educates in dozens of these types of therapies like IV nutrients, chelation, bioidentical hormones, peptides, neural therapy, ozone. So we're going to talk about all these longevity things. Welcome to the podcast, Jason.
Thank you so much for having me today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I stumbled upon your account on Instagram and I thought, wow, this sounds very educated and very reasonable approach to doing, peptides and things that are slightly off label. What's the kind of governmental regulatory environment like in Chicago where you practice? Is it super strict? Do you have a lot of trouble prescribing these things?
No, I'd say in Chicago it's pretty easy. And I would say that over the years, when I first started education, I wanted to get the word out. This started years ago, 4 years ago, actually. I think beginning of March, I started posting a video a day on Instagram and just started with, "Hey, let me talk about something no one's talking about," which at the time, peptides were not really in vogue like they are now. Now you can't open Instagram without seeing someone talk about peptides and longevity, and you're like, "How did this happen?" Every person that's got a microphone is now speaking on this, educated or not. And so I started this kind of in the beginning, thinking. I was on Reddit boards actually responding back to people on peptide forums, like all the Reddit forums, like peptides, peptides. And I was like the one person, I feel like the reasonable person in the room saying, this is what we use and this is how we use it, and this is what I'm doing. And it kind of just turned morphed into, I wanted to go to a different form of communication, and Instagram picked up as this option. So I started talking about this stuff. And over the years, I love about my platform is that I constantly get corrected. Other practitioners, other scientists, people reach out to me and say things to me, and it's allowed me to become a much better practitioner by educating. The more education I give, the more people come back to me and say, "You're actually wrong about this." That's great. I want to be wrong. Let me be wrong so I can find a way to correct myself and then come back to the community and say, "This is what I found," because I don't want people to miscommunicate misinformation out just as much as anyone else does. So it kind of was an accident I fell into this. And I'd say here in Chicago, we have a really good, easy board of pharmacy. I can tell you other states like Ohio has a really awful board of pharmacy. In fact, they came in recently, I know in Ohio, and they just decimated all these wellness spas and basically took all the peptides and kind of like shut everything down. In fact, a lot of pharmacies won't ship to Ohio now. They're like, "Nope, we're not messing with Ohio. The board of pharmacy is awful." So thankfully in Chicago, there has been anything bad that's happened. They've been, in general, I think peptides are fairly safe when used correctly. There isn't much that can happen. Now, again, some peptides don't have much human insight and information on them, right? Like BPC-157, very commonly talked about in the wellness community for healing. But we have two human studies with little data. I mean, we have, like 13 or 20 patients these, and it's one was an injection, I think an orthopedic study, and one was an oral study. That doesn't confer much, sentiment of safety. We're looking at 10, 20 years of data, right? We have drugs like Benadryl, we have blood pressure drugs, hydrochlorothiazide, and we have years and years of data. The reason I think everyone gets on the case of, well, it doesn't matter if the FDA approved. Yeah, I mean, I can definitely say that sometimes the FDA approves drugs that may not work very well, but the whole point of the FDA is safety, right? Their entire point is, how do we make this safe? And I think what really is hard, the peptide world, is that we see people shouting at the top of the lungs, "BPC for the rest of your life." And look, I love BPC. I think it's great, but I also want to put it out there. Look, there isn't much scientific literature on humans. Rat studies, sure, we got plenty of information, but a rat is not a human. There are plenty of drugs in rats that will kill humans, and rats are just fine. So, do you want to trust these studies? So I am trying to be some more reasonable about the way I approach this stuff, and there are mechanisms we can understand how this works, but I think the lack of human data is what scares a lot of people. And I think that's what regulatory boards are scared of, right? It's the lack of human data that we see, which is what the fear is with everyone. Now we have GLP-1s out, and yet here's GLP-1s, probably one of the newest, best drugs that existed, that's come out to help people, and people are afraid of that. And there is FDA approval. And then people are upset. It's like you have one camp that says FDA doesn't matter. And they look at GLP-1s, well, FDA, these things are going to kill you. Well, they're FDA approved. Nope, doesn't matter. But then they might be taking BPC-157. I'm like, wait, hold on. This is the safe thing. Like, this is the thing that's been studied. So it's a very interesting field right now. I think we've all kind of get the idea that wellness has really kind of taken a turn in the last 10 years, right? We see Gen Z aren't even drinking as much. Alcohol consumption's gone down. I think the wellness factor's really picked up. People want yoga and Pilates, and they think about their health more than they did 10, 20 years ago. So it's been a really kind of wild west field. And 4 years when I started this, there was less of the information, less people coming out and talking about this. So I wanted to promote as much education as I could. So whatever I was learning, let me go back and talk about it. And let me tell you, I mean, you've been to seminars like me. We walk out of a seminar and you're like, my head just exploded. I don't remember everything. I take this much information out. I go back and reread it and stuff. I'm like, oh, okay. But when someone presents something, the slides don't always maybe match what they say, or maybe they're saying things that I missed. So when I'm talking about this stuff, there's stuff in my videos. And I look back to my original videos, I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I said this stuff back then. You know, I had probably even learned this and didn't remember it. So I'm telling stuff, I'm like, oh my gosh, I didn't say this. I didn't, oh, I forgot this mechanism. So I
It's
mean, to
funny
answer your question.
as it explodes on social media and gets so popular, I'm looking back at my old lectures on peptides and I'm like, this year I'm going to be lecturing much more stringently about regulatory safety, sterility, and all the things. Because I feel like airline stewardess. I was on a plane and an airline stewardess was trying to sell me peptides, but she got me for her gym bro. And I was just like, wait, what's your background? Oh, you're an airline stewardess. Okay. You just know this stuff. Like,
I
what?
love that. I have a similar story. I was in Miami sitting down eating outside, and my friend are sitting there, and you know, this girl next to us is talking to this guy who's overweight, man, and she talks about retatrutide. I can't look, I go, retatrutide, talk about retatrutide. Just yeah. I go, oh, so like, are you in the, you know, do you talk about peptides? She goes, yeah, I'm a Pilates instructor, and I have a giant social media following, and I sell peptides. And I'm like,
Oh
oh
God, I
man.
know my own patients. I have a
Oh.
couple of influencer beautiful girls who are doing the same
Yeah.
thing, and I just want to call the state medical board. And then they
Yeah.
wouldn't even do anything because it's such a
Because they're not licensed. They're not
regulated
licensed. What are they
zone.
going to do to them? And I also think I have a
Well, they're
problem. I
practicing
think
medicine. I feel like they're practicing medicine without a license.
they may be, but it's really hard to go to people that have no license at all. It's like it, as a practitioner, they can take your license. They can come after you. When you're, I found this is the problem. When you're not a practitioner, there is little that that they can come after you. It's really hard to go after them. It's easier to take your license and my license and screw us over than to go after them because, well, I
Like,
put
what
on
do they have
there
to
no
lose?
medical. Yeah, what am I going to lose? I have no license. Like, who
I'm in
cares? I can't. Yeah,
Pilates. Take my
exactly.
Pilates license.
Exactly. And I think the other frustration I think both you and I see is these influencers we see, they're beautiful people to start with. They're younger. So when you see a 25-year-old to 29-year-old talking about peptides, I look great. I feel great in these peptides. You're just young. Like that's the beauty of being young. So we talk about these, you know, we talk about GHKC as a beauty peptide, and there's not much human data on the injection. There's good in, you know, some human data on topicals, and they will push this stuff. And like it's, I still talk about it. I think it's a useful peptide to discuss. But I think it to be, you know, to be cautioned of what works and what doesn't work and what has human data. And I see these promoters talk about it, and this girl's like, I use GHKC and I feel great. My skin is great. I'm thinking, you're 26 years old. You don't have lines and wrinkles because you're 26 years old. Like, of course you look like this. And you try to claim it's because of a peptide. I want to say, who? But the problem is they have these giant followings because they're, you know, somewhat cute girls. Now they're selling peptides. I'm thinking,
The other problem
the.
is these stacks that they're putting together
Of
where they're doing
course.
combinations of therapies or putting multiple peptides in a bottle where the results are really different then because, I think, okay, if you're going to try peptides, let's do one and try it for like 90 days and really understand, do you feel a difference or is it placebo effect or not? But then when you do
Exactly.
combination therapies, you're going to have no clue what's doing what.
That's and so I'm very unless I have a like a patient coming in that maybe had surgery. I mean the glow stack is what you're basically referring to, the combination one. It's BP757, TB500, GHKCO. You know, and unless I have surgery, I'm like, let's just try them separately and see what you think. And then if you put them together, sure. There is good data showing that when you mix them all together, there is a faster degradation of them together. So yes, it does cost a little less to have them mixed together. So patients like the fact it's less expensive, but there is some more degradation. Theoretically, using them all separately, putting them in one syringe and then drawing them right into an injection right away is the best overall for degradation. But I know ease of use. People like what's easier to use. So you lose a little more potency, but it's easier to use. Okay, what do you want to do here? And I do agree. You have to, you know, you want to check what things work, right? To be a good scientist. And if we're all basically, I mean, we're all lab rats with these peptides because there's not a lot of human data. So if you want to know what your own body's doing, you have to know what's affecting it. Because, like you said, if we do things more than once at a time, because I see clinics that are saying, let's get you on five peptides to start. And people come to see me and say, oh, I feel great. Well, what am I taking that's making me feel great? And I say, I don't know. There's a lot of things you're taking. I don't know what's doing zero for you. And I don't know what's making the biggest movement. And I love peptide medicine. I think peptides are great. But I think the foundation we always miss is, for most of our patients is what's your diet, what's your exercise, what's your nutrition status? Are you hydrated? Like these things matter so much because no peptide is going to fix, you not exercising and you eating processed foods every day. I don't care how many GLP-1s you take. If you're eating Twinkies and, you're going to grab your Starburst and whatever processed foods you can, you'll lose weight, but you're not going to be, you're going to get skinny fat, right? We're missing out on that protein, right? So I'm very big on cautioning patients on you have to have that protein content if you're doing any weight loss. And I think the biggest thing we probably both see in practice is people lose weight. 70% of people in America are overweight. They want to get that weight loss down. What can I do? And we always, my favorite thing is a GLP-1. I think GLP-1s work very effectively. Semaglutide and tirzepatide are great products. Retatrutide is, right now gray market and, found online. People are trying this and I hear people call them retta rats. Like, hey, you're taking retatrutide. You're a rat right now. Now there is a phase 3 trial that's finished, but it hasn't been fully approved. So even when all of them come out, it's still considered gray market because until it's approved, it's not a drug. So I do caution patients on that because you don't know what you're buying when you buy online. You don't know if it's quality controlled. You know what's being tested for. A friend of mine used to own a lab and he made the lab because he was buying from China and selling online. And he goes, 70% of stuff I tested was probably okay. 30% is not. 30% is a wide range to be getting the bad product. So he's like, I made my own lab. I actually bought, he had bought Eli Lilly, no, Novo Nordisk. He bought their peptide synthesizer. So he had to use their peptide synthesizers and made semaglutide on Novo Nordisk peptide synthesizer. So that's pretty ironic. But he had sold his lab and he would tell me when he had his lab open, he was testing a lot of these products from a lot of companies. He goes, everyone was failing. And I'd email them, hey, by the way, I tested your product. You actually failed. Like, just to give you a heads up, like, so you can correct it. And no one responded back to him, right? People blocked him. They got angry. And he's like, I'm trying to help you. I'm not coming at you with anger. I'm saying, you have a product that's inferior, that's unsafe. Don't use it. In fact, he had said at one point, he had heard of one of the labs that he worked with, he knew about, had got a shipment. I believe they had gotten a shipment of semaglutide and they were supposed to have gotten tirzepatide. Well, you can imagine if a patient takes semaglutide instead of tirzepatide, the same dosing, and they're like, oh, I'm taking this 2.5 milligram dosing. I mean, let's say they're taking 5 milligrams. I'm at 5 already. I should be taking 5 of this tirzepatide. Well, if they're on a 5 milligram dose of semaglutide, that's well double the total dose that you're supposed to take, and you're going to feel like garbage. They're going to feel so disgustingly sick, and that's
It's
because
really,
the
I think
lab.
that's the biggest challenge. Like, you don't know what's in the bottle, like the ingredients, the purity, the stability, the shelf stability. The most important is how sterile is it? Like, it's very easy to get peptides now on Amazon and right on Google, research grade. And people might convince themselves, well, it's fine. If it's sterile for a research lab, it's sterile for me. But it's definitely not.
No,
So,
and I think we forget endotoxins. That's a big thing I talk about all the time. Endotoxins are a major problem. They're not clean the same way that compounding pharmacies do. So these endotoxins can cause major issues and it can get you really sick. And people don't think about this. Again, it's what's cheapest. I will say that I've noticed women in general are more iffy about going to compounding, going to these like online labs. It's my men I always worry about. My men are like, oh, who cares about the risk? I'm going to go buy online. It's $20 for this bottle. I'm like, oh, I don't think that's a good
Well,
quality. You should maybe
talk a
think
little
about
bit
that.
about the compounding pharmacy, 503A and 503B type.
For
What
sure.
should patients look for?
So 503 and 503B and 503A. You can be asking for COA, certificate of analysis. It's a big one. Also, they come from a GMP certified facility. So most, I would tell you, actually not even most, every pharmacy that exists other than a 503B. 503B could be making their own peptides. But a lot of 503Bs and all 503As are buying bulk powder from somewhere. So that bulk powder could be from anywhere. Yes. Now, are people getting this from China? Yeah. There's a lot of labs in China. It's super inexpensive to make this, but the labs that exist in China are GMP certified. They're considered FDA registered. You have to have FDA registration to ship to any compounding facility. And that means it's been inspected by the FDA. They've come in, they've looked at the facility, and it has to be GMP certification. So at the minimum level, we need GMP certification. A lot of these online labs that are just selling peptides research grade do not have GMP certification. They're just a middleman grabbing the product and saying, hey, this is ours. When product is being made and distributed, that comes from GMP certified facility, and compounding pharmacies are also GMP certified. So you want to check, number one, is this GMP certified? That's number one. Number two, is it FDA registered? Is someone going there and checking on this stuff? Because they do have regular check-ins. It is actually more frequent that they check on compounding pharmacies than they do on general drug companies that are making drugs. So if you're a giant drug manufacturer doing some kind of generic drug, you're less likely to get inspected than a compounding pharmacy. Now, does this mean compounding pharmacies are elite and way better? No, it just means the FDA is a little more concerned with compounding because, again, compounding is, could be very unsafe. So I always say GMP certification, FDA registered, those are your top two things. You can ask for COAs. You can ask your provider if you want. I can tell you right now, I don't have the COAs and all these things, right? I don't have them. I'm sure you don't have them. We don't have act. We're not getting them, and no
Well, the
pharmacy's sending
problem
me
is
this.
also it's like tested at one point in time. Like they'll test one batch, and do they do that for every batch, every model?
Exactly. That's the question.
They should
So
test every batch, but I don't really think that they do.
they don't, and it is expensive. In fact, they actually, most of these compounding pharmacies, these 503As, they send you stuff with 30 days as a BUD date. So the beyond use date is listed on everything. And it's once you puncture the bottle, you have 30 days. The reason the BUD date is 30 days on all these things is because there's a special test they have to spend, I can't remember, $7,000 or $10,000 per item to have an extended beyond use date. So they can prove it lasts beyond 30 days. Most of these products, like the GLP-1s, there is a general belief it does last longer than this, but it has to be proven. So they can't do that, and it is expensive for them to do. So if they change GMP certified GMP manufacturers, so they got a GLP-1 from this facility and then switched, they'd have to get test all over again. So I've talked to a bunch of pharmacies, and they say, here's the thing, we would make longer BUD dates, but it is so expensive when we have 30 or 40 SKUs. And we switch all of a sudden, we have to retest. So that becomes an 8,000 per item all the way on the list. So one thing I think people worry about, and I see patients, I get them on a GLP-1, they're like, this is a 30-day BUD date. I'm like, yes, but that's FDA required for any 503A. They've made it very stringent. It used to be a little bit longer, 45 days to 60 days, and they kept cutting it down further and further. So basically, like, hey, steroid water, BAC steroid water lasts for 30 days once punctured. We're going to say the same thing about all these peptides. That's it. Again, yeah, there is that. They test batch to batch. I do believe they test. They do test batch to batch. I can't say that because when they do get a new batch in, when they order, when pharmacies get stuff, I'm always, hey, when's this coming out? And they're like, well, we have to test this batch. A lot of pharmacies will release a batch. When it's in testing, they'll have like they usually do like some pharmacies do two tests and test it one place, then test another third party. And once the first test comes back, they will release it and send it out. In fact, this happened to me of NAD a few years ago. The first test came back for endotoxins and everything was fine. They released the batch. And I think with a week later, they had the second endotoxin test come back and everything was completely out of range. So they immediately recalled it, right? And that's the big thing I want to say about pharmacies rather than these other labs online. If there's something happens and someone tests the batch and tells the place, hey, by the way, this batch was bad. It has endotoxins. It has this. It has heavy metals. Are these places contacting these people that bought it? No. Who
No,
cares?
we
That's
don't have a
whatever.
tracking mechanism, so
No.
you'll never even hear back if you got a bad batch. You'll just
No.
end up in the hospital
No.
or something.
And 50 exactly. And 503As, that was happened. This NAD happened. They recalled. They went to the patients, recalled. And I had multiple patients like it burned. I had welts. Well, I was able to say, hey. The pharmacy reached out to all of them and said, we're going to replace everything. We're really sorry. Endotoxins were in there. The first test said, none. So what usually happens is you get a testing from the actual company, the GMP certified facility to send you the product, the powder will first test it and tell you it's fine. Then the pharmacy will do a secondary test, do a verification, usually two third party tests on top of that. They usually have an in-house test and they usually send out of house. So once it passes their in-house testing, then they have a third-party test and they're like, wait a week. But if it's past their in-part person or their in-house one, they'll usually send it out. And this happened with the NAD and it passed the in-house and then it didn't pass the out-of-house. And they, immediately contacted the vendor and the vendor had actually lied on their initial endotoxin testing. And this is why it matters. They were like, they dropped the vendor. They're like, we're no longer using them. They switched vendors. It's a whole pain in the butt for them, obviously, the pharmacy, but the safety, right? Now I have, again, a bunch of patients that would have gotten this product ended up not getting it. Some did, unfortunately, but we were able to stop, they were able to stop it and keep that going. So I think safety is so important. And this is why compounding pharmacies do matter. They're so liable. If you have a reaction and you end up in the hospital, and that can happen from some of these things, You have no one responsible when you're a research company. Well, you're a lab rat. You said you were, it says not human right in
Yeah,
the
it's
bottle. It
not
says not for human
viability,
use.
but
Exactly.
so
So
you're
whose
responsible
liability?
for your own risks,
Yeah. And
basically.
again, listen, for $60 for a bottle of GLP-1s, maybe some people think it's worth it, right? That's playing Russian roulette, just hoping that gun doesn't go off and you should just be fine. Unfortunately, I think a lot of clients, and I gotta say again, especially my females, are much more cognizant. Like, look, I'm not taking that risk with my health. Maybe someone else can, but I'm not risking that. I want something that's safe and I can trust. And compounding pharmacies are typically that safe person you can trust because, again, if something does happen, someone is liable. They can go back to the compounding pharmacy and sue them, like, hey, you are ultimately responsible for everything that happened to this. This is your product. You made it. I'm consuming it because of you. You say it's for use in humans. I need someone to come and do something for me. And
Yeah.
again, I think that's my big fear because
And
I
they
haven't.
answer to a pharmacy board, so they have to follow their
100%.
they have a pharmacy license. So I think that's definitely the safest way to go.
100%.
But I want to jump into a little bit
Yeah.
about the growth hormone and growth hormone analogs and tell me
Yeah.
your clinical experience with that and why do you like it so much for your patients right now?
Yeah. So we lose growth hormone about 15% a decade. By the time you hit 60, you're now 10% of the growth hormone you made when you were in your teens, in your puberty. So growth hormone, just like other hormones, usually like testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, they just start dropping. That's what happens. It's part of the aging process. Growth hormone does a lot of great things. It can work on sexual function. It can work on brain function. It can work on muscle mass and fat loss. It's been working on energy, your mood, your skin, hair, nails. Immune system gets better. It works on overall repair recovery. So it covers a lot of things. They call it the jack of all trades, master of none. So everything just gets better, but nothing's amazing. And sleep is a big one. The big thing people notice on growth hormone peptides is the sleep improvements. That's usually the first thing people see. So all those other things can happen. And when we lose growth hormone part of aging, what happens is there are cells, the pituitary, they basically go dormant. Somatostatin kind of just goes down and says, somatotropes are like, we're just not working anymore. We're still here, but there's no signaling. So I always tell people, think of a fan in the background. If I had this fan in the back of me and every 2 minutes it got louder and louder, I'd be screaming to talk to you. I need like a bullhorn or just some other way to talk to you. What ends up happening is the communication to the cells goes down. So what we wind up doing is giving some kind of growth hormone secretagogues, growth hormone releasing hormone, and those will improve the actual signaling. And signaling is what really is going to matter. Can we get the signal to the pituitary to get growth hormone back out? So I'm a big believer in using the growth hormone secretagogues over giving growth hormone, mostly because growth hormone has separate isoforms when we make it naturally. These separate isoforms do different things. When you give just growth hormone, you get one isoform only, and that's it. It is the most commonly used and the strongest isoform that does a lot of these things, but it also causes insulin sensitivity, which is not what we want. Insulin sensitivity is very bad for the body. So the body producing its own natural production of growth hormone is always going to be better than giving it growth hormone by itself. People who take growth hormone by itself will feel better. They're like, growth hormone works great. Of course it works great. It is, you're giving the exogenous growth hormone at levels super physiologic than what you're making. You couldn't even make that if you wanted. When we give growth hormone back to patients with things like sermorelin, which is the weakest of the growth hormone releasing hormones, and then the CJC1295, which is kind of the middle child of what people use in practice, and this testosterone, which is the strongest. It is the only, I guess, sermorelin and testosterone FDA approved. Testosterone is really the strongest. It has about a 4 to 5 times output of growth hormone compared to CJC1295, and it has about 40% more IGF-1 being increased, which again is really the downstream effect of growth hormone, which is what drives a lot of the benefits we see with the muscle mass repair, fat loss situation. So, why do I use growth hormone peptides? Growth hormone releasing hormone is an amazing option. It's going to release more growth hormone. The growth hormone releasing peptide, something like apamarin, which is growth hormone releasing hormone, think of that as the brakes. It's going to take the brakes off the pituitary, allow more release of growth hormone, whereas the growth hormone releasing hormone is going to just be the gas to go down. You need the gas, you need the brakes off for a car to go forward. So we give these together very often to improve overall output of your growth hormone. Improving this is going to make you feel all these great things. And again, we lose it as we age. By giving the signaling back, you wake up the dormant cells, they start producing growth hormone again. The signaling isn't there. You give signaling back, guess what? You start producing growth hormone again. Are you making growth hormone that you made at 18 again? No, that's just not possible. But you're going to make some growth hormone. My mom is currently 80, about to be 80 this year. And I have her on CJC 1295 there from her. She's not even on test run. I'm like, I pay for all of her care, so you're gonna get the CJC mom. I'm not gonna spend more money on you. Test run's a little more expensive. But she loves it. When she takes it, she really likes how she feels. Her sleep gets better, you know, her mood is better. She sees all these improvements in there. And we actually have clinical studies on Tesamorelin showing this is what it does. So when we talk about peptides and studies and human studies, Sermorelin and Tesamorelin have great human studies. In fact, I made a post yesterday about Tesamorelin and cycling it. Technically, in all the studies, Tesamorelin is meant to be long-term use. It's used for HIV lipodystrophy, meaning if you're HIV, you're on HIV drugs, you get that fat kind of around your organs and fat around your belly. What it can do is reduce that fat, which is a big deal. As you get fat around your organs, you have increased risk of mortality. So what it does is it can reduce visceral adipose tissue, that by up to 20% over 52 weeks. What they have found in studies is once you stop, that visceral adipose tissue goes back up. Why is that? Because when you take growth hormone, you have less fat. That is what growth hormone does. And as you age, growth hormone goes down, which means visceral fat goes up. So kind of the idea is long-term Tesamorelin use would reduce visceral fat long-term. Now, the studies all show long-term use of it's fine. They have, I think, up to 2 to 3 years of long-term use in patients showing, hey, it's safe, it's effective, keep using it. What I tell people, though, is the growth hormone receptors at some point don't respond as well. They get used to the same hit to their mechanism every time to the receptor. So I recommend, you know, like a 12-week on, kind of 4-week off protocol. Do 12 weeks and take 4 weeks off. Is that you know, necessary? Absolutely no. Studies show you can be on it. There's human studies showing years of this use. It's not going to hurt you. So someone that doesn't take Tesamorelin and someone takes it for 2 years is going to be better off than the person who doesn't take it. But if you cycle it, we do understand the receptors can actually start working better, so you get more use out of it. So again, you don't have to, and this is the kind of the nuance is you don't have to cycle this stuff. The growth hormone peptides could theoretically be used long term. But again, cycling is going to be a much better option because you can reset those receptors and let them work better. Now, CJC 1295 does have a human study on it. It was actually meant to be a drug. What ended up happening is someone ended up having a heart attack when taking CJC 1295 in the study, and the drug company was like, nope, we're not being involved. Someone had a heart attack. We're done. We're out. The lead investigator came back and said, yeah, I don't think it was all related at all. Like, the lead investigator was like, this isn't related, we should keep using it. So there is this one human study on it, and then again something happened, it was major. And so drug companies don't like any kind of risk at all. They're very risk averse, so they were not about to take this to a larger population and see what happens, because if something happened to three patients, then now they're legally responsible. So we do believe CJC 1295 would work as effectively as Tesamorelin without any of this adverse effects that we thought might happen, based on the lead investigator also saying, hey, I don't think this is going to happen. This is just a random one-off. It was just an unlucky situation for this patient. But unfortunately, you know, some people do quote this and say, hey, CJC 1295, someone died in the study. Yeah, but not exactly from this CJC 1295. It just randomly could have happened. It's an unlucky scenario. So
Do
again,
you
I
worry
use
much about like the suppression of the natural growth hormone pulses? And I think that's one big concern that patients should be aware of, that you know, if you're injecting growth hormone directly, you can definitely suppress your pituitary
Correct.
cycling. So
Correct.
what's your best mechanism to get around that?
Well, the thing about the growth hormone peptides is they're signaling, but they're signaling you to make more. So what I like about it is just a signal. So you take the signal away, you're going back to where you were. I tell people most time takes about a month because the half-life of these things is a little bit, you know, at least Tesamorelin has the longest half-life. You could see about a month of them staying higher at this growth hormone level, and then eventually fades back to zero to where they're at. So whatever level they're at, they're going to go right back to that. And also, let's be real, if you're 6 years old, your growth hormone's already almost gone. It's been depleted, you know, super low. It's like people who take testosterone and decide to come off testosterone after 20 years. And I say, well, your testosterone level of 20 years is probably next to zero anyway. So whether or not you took it or didn't take it, you'd probably want to be on testosterone anyways if you're a 70-year-old, 75-year-old man. So I don't think there's enough suppression from the growth hormone peptides because they're signaling to make more. The suppression we get from taking growth hormone is going to actually suppress and cause more downregulation and stop production. Whereas the signaling molecules, the peptides, signal making more. Hey, please make more body. So I don't worry about the suppression with the peptides like I do with the growth hormone.
And then are you guys recommending labs for everybody? I do also feel that people start taking peptides with absolutely no lab work. And if you're going to get on something like growth hormone or analogs, you definitely need to check your fasting glucose, your hemoglobin A1C, your thyroid panel, like thinking about your insulin growth factor.
Yeah.
I really hope people out there are doing getting labs and working with a physician if they're going to start peptides. It's so important, or a qualified practitioner like yourself.
Yeah, and that's why I made videos on this. In fact, I teach on peptides, and when I sit there and say, look, you need to have labs, basic labs. I mean, this is basic stuff. You don't have to go down the rabbit hole and do a homocysteine on everyone, but if you're not doing a hemoglobin C in all these patients, you're going to run some risk. If you start seeing this drift up on hemoglobin C, they go from a 5.0 with, normal blood sugar to a 5.2 to a 5.4, 5.6. Well, is their diet changing? Are they now eating different? Or are you seeing this drift from growth hormone? Now, growth hormone can cause some insulin sensitivity. And even the studies have shown long-term use of even testosterone can potentially cause a drift of insulin sensitivity. It can cause some changes. So even with that, you still want to be careful. Like, you want to have basic labs. And I think you're right. Most people that buy this stuff online, they're just taking it. And I think the big problem I think we're facing here in medicine right now is so many practitioners don't either know peptides, don't understand them, don't know how to use them or why to use them. So they're against them, or they don't talk about them, which then means their patients will have to say, well, I'm reading this on Instagram. I'm seeing this in my stories and my TikTok. I'm seeing it all over the place. Well, I'm going to start doing it myself because you don't clearly know what you're doing. I'm going to research it myself. And that becomes a really dangerous gray field for the patients, right? Because now they have no one to go to. And I think what also hurts us is the telehealth laws that we have in place. In 2020, when COVID got rid of all the telehealth laws, you could be anywhere in the country and see a patient very simply and easily because telehealth just was everywhere. We've now cracked back down on that. And now, if you're in a state and you're in a rural area and you have no doctor near you to find this stuff, it's really hard to find someone to know who to talk to and go through this. Because if your local doctor is, one of three in the city, who do you go to talk to? Now I got to find someone randomly to talk about this stuff and to work with. And I like, don't get me wrong, Hims and companies like Hims are great, at least they're providing GLP-1s, but it's asynchronous care. So they're not following your labs. They don't care what your lab work says. They just say, here you go, good luck.
They don't really
Sleep.
watch the person as
No.
a full patient, and like you,
100%.
on top of what you're taking, you still have your baseline medical problems. You have your health
Yeah.
history that nobody knows what the drug interactions are between your peptides and your regular drugs that you're on. So
Yeah.
like people tend to forget that you're still, a patient and an organism that has health issues, and
Yeah.
epigenetics can impact you.
Of course. And so asynchronous care is expensive, right? Synchronous care, talking to patient week after week for months and months, is expensive care. Asynchronous is cheap, right? They just call you and say, hey doc, I need my GLP-1. Cool, bye. You're safe. You don't have cancer. You don't have any of these issues. Good luck. It's super cheap to provide that. It is expensive to provide synchronous care, and people want cheap, affordable options. So I can understand what people go towards, Hims or Hers or other big name places. And for GLP-1s, okay, maybe that's not the issue here. But if we're doing things like growth hormone peptides, maybe we do need to have a little closer look. We should have some lab work being done. And I do think it's really important to have baseline labs on people that do growth hormone peptides. And even on patients that use regenerative peptides, BP757, GHKCU, EB500. Like, you can look at lab work in some patients, you can say, you can go to CBC and say, you might have, anemia from cancer, right? And I can call that out and be like, oh, you're definitely not taking peptides right now, but we need to fix this and figure out why you have anemia before I even get down this rabbit hole. So even basic labs can give you an idea if something's going on in a patient. Again, is there a cancer screening that everyone can get on? Because I think the big thing people worry about is cancer going to happen? Can I cause cancer? Will I grow it? They don't have a good lab for that, right? There's Novo, which does a whole body scan. It's experimental. Rail testing is experimental. It's a blood spot. They are useful, but they're not going to be the pure fix. So at least having some base of somewhere to start with, you can see if things change when you're on something, is super useful. And if you're not doing labs, you're not with a practitioner, you might be very unlucky. And maybe the first year is fine, but maybe that second year something happens. And now you don't know what to do. And who you go and see doesn't have any idea what's going on. They don't even understand the peptides. So they're confused with what, and they don't know where you got them, right? You're buying them from some place online that no one's heard of. I mean, I've seen these places and they shut down. I had a place I used to watch, Camerino's something, and they were selling steroids. They were selling, nandrolone and deca and all sorts of drugs. I'm thinking, dear God, there's people, there are going to be, I'm telling you, I know there's teenage men out there. This testosterone maxing is a thing on Instagram now. They're like, taking
Oh my
testosterone,
God, it's so
I'm
awful.
testosterone maxing. And you're like, this is what they're doing. But you're a teenage boy and your testosterone's flying. You're like, I can do anything. I feel like $1 million. I'm safe. And the next thing you know, something majorly bad happens to them. And like, this is the point of the safety mechanisms that the FDA does put in place. And I get there's been lots of controversy. After COVID, everyone started distrusting the medical community in general. I think everything just kind of fell to the wayside, and we lost a lot of people who had faith in the system. And now everyone's, what's ChatGPT say? What's Grok say? What's Gemini say? What do these things say? Okay, it says it's safe. I'm good to take it. I'm good to go. So I do fear AI modeling coming out and saying, yep, you can take this if you have this, because I don't know how much AI you use in your practice, but I use a lot of it. And a lot of times AI tells me the wrong thing. And
I
I'll say,
use a lot,
that's, yeah, it's wrong. I'm like, listen, AI is great for when you understand what you're doing. It's a good resource to help you kind of, figure things out. When you don't understand something at all, using AI is not going to solve the issue for you. You need to have some basic level of understanding to get an idea of if it's right or wrong. If you don't know if it's right or wrong, you have no idea what you're doing. And I can look at dosing on AI and be like, that's not at all the dosing I would do. That's not at all what I expect to happen. And patients will research this stuff. And when I saw ChatGPT said this, and I'm sure you can then, ChatGPT said this
I
about
think
this.
even for some people who know what they're doing, like I still rely on my friends who've been doing it for 20 years because,
100%.
maybe I've been doing it for 8 years, but the people who've been doing it for 20 years have that clinical track record of they've gone through what their patients' experiences, and you bank that in your head, and that's better than any AI. I think that's truly
100%.
like the machine learning that needs to happen. And since a lot of people are just starting at year one, or they have no knowledge, or they're doing it in Pilates class or whatever, like they don't have that machine learning. So like I think even at my stage, and maybe perhaps even at your stage, you have friends who've been doing it 20 years, and like they're kind of the pioneers. So I'm following those people and understanding them. But
Exactly.
when you're seeing patients, is there anything that you think is a stop? Like, okay, I won't give peptides because you have cancer history, you have a recent stroke or things like this. Are there patients
For
that
sure.
are meant to stop?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you have active cancer,
Or
there
don't
is
start.
absolutely, yeah. I mean, if you have an active cancer patient, I've had active cancer patients come to me and say, why don't we take growth hormone? I've heard it helps muscle mass and I'm losing muscle. I'm like, well, no, we're not doing any of that. So active cancer is an automatic hard stop for multiple peptides. You could be on a GLP-1. That's not my concern. That's not a cancer, drug that I'm worried about causing to grow cancer. But anything growth, I mean, any kind of growth hormone is going to do that. Any kind of repair peptide, BP757, GHKCU, TD500, they're going to grow more blood vessels. More blood vessels are going to lead to basically growing cancer. Cancer wants more blood. They need more nutrients. So I'm always very cautious about using any kind of cancer and what peptides. There's a very small handful of thymosin alpha 1 is one of the few peptides I use in cancer, a GLP-1. Those are two of the top ones I can think of in cancer. I'm like, okay, that's safe. Outside of that, there are contraindications to taking peptides in general. When I'm thinking about GLP-1s, I've had patients that are super low blood sugar. They come into me and their blood sugar hemoglobin A1C is 4.2, 4.1. It's already super low. I don't want to suppress that further. They're going to go into hypoglycemia. Like, we want to be, this is why labs are important. You don't know what's going on until you look at the labs. Without lab data, you have zero idea what to call this patient. And you could make them worse by putting them on peptides. So I am definitely cautious about using peptides in general. Cancer is obviously the biggest kind of hard stop. Lactation, pregnancy are big ones. If they have an allergy, commonly the growth hormone peptides are the most likely to cause an allergy in the future. So if you have taken peptides before, growth hormone releasing hormones such as Surmulin, CDC-1295, Tesferlin, those get anaphylaxis. In fact, I had a patient recently reach out to me. They did an injection, got a little hive at the site. Oh, what do I do next? And I'm like, you stop. You just stop totally. We don't even restart right now. We're taking a break. Typically, I restart at lower dosages. But I've had people who've reached out to the internet. I did a shot and I went to the ER because my throat started closing. Yeah, that's a major problem. And people don't understand. I saw someone recently talking, do you get a hive with your injection? Just inject some KPV over it. And I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
I've seen that.
You do not do that.
Don't
Like,
mask the problem.
I'm like, that's your body's reaction. It's not a thing you're trying to hide. So I was like, I see this, and someone posted this. I'm thinking they were had a, it was their account, and I said, I responded back, hey, maybe you don't just recommend taking KPV. Maybe you recommend them seeing someone at this point, or recommend at least complete stop for now, not touching it. I think it's, and again, it's a health influencer. So what is this? And a couple hundred thousand people follow this person. So what are these people doing? They're going to listen to this guy says. I've been following him for years. He seemed really reasonable. I'll keep injecting. And that one person ends up in the ER, ends up dead now because they went through straight anaphylaxis and throat closed. But yeah, that happened because they could have just taken some reasonable medical advice of stopping the peptide. So if you see hives of any site, at any point when you're doing peptides, stop and talk to someone. Do not just keep injecting through the hive, because that can get worse. It can take one more. It's like the first bee sting someone gets, they get a hive, and the second one can kill you. So you don't want to get to that second one and then be like, oh God, this is now what do I do? I'm too late. I don't have an EpiPen. I don't know what, I don't do any Benadryl. What do I do? So I'm very cautious about reactions. So if patients have reactions, I'm very, very huge about making sure that we address their reactions they have. So really, the big thing for me is cancer, low blood sugar, my most common things I'm looking at for. Am I worried about the future? Do I risk a patient being on this stuff?
I think let's talk a little bit about NAD briefly because that is so trending and popular, and I want people to go away with some of your knowledge and interest. So, how do you recommend that people should dose NAD? What form? NADH, NADPH? I like NAD precursors like nicotinamide riboside or NMN. But tell me a little bit about your thoughts on IV versus oral and like, symptoms that you see people having, and what kind of great results can you have with NAD?
Course. By the way, have you tried nicotinamide riboside IV before in your
No, I
practice?
have not
Okay.
actually.
Yeah, so it's a good one. If you have any patient that's taken the one reason I don't like NADIV is the time constraint, right? For me to sit under an IV for 4 hours is a waste of my time. And I tell patients, we have high-end patients are coming in. Do you have 4 hours to sit here for an IV? That's hard to do. Nicotinamide riboside, you can open up and run full throttle, get very similar results because it's the precursor and actually gets into the cell better. So there's a company, I can't remember who it is now, but makes nicotinamide riboside as an IV. You can also do sub-Q injections. It is a bit more expensive, so patients don't want to spend more money. They'll maybe they do the NAD. But for patients like, I don't care what it costs, I just want it fast, nicotinamide riboside IV is a good option. You can do it sub-Q. I think sub-Q NAD by itself, NAD plus, actually works a little bit better. I think NADH is like the king. It's just hard to find compounding pharmacies that make it. They just make NAD plus. So I typically don't find NADH. There's a couple places I know that make it, but they're technically labs, they're not pharmacies. I'm a big fan of NAD. I think it's really useful for patients out there. We do deplete NAD as we age, it goes down. So giving it back is a really great thing to do. There are precursors. You can take niacin, nicotinamide riboside, and NMN, nicotinamide mononucleotide. All three are useful. People have taken those, they'll comment, they'll say this. I post these stories and post these videos. Tell me your experience of taking the orals. And people are like, I feel next to nothing. You might see improvements in skin, hair, nails, maybe you have a little more energy, but it takes weeks to see improvements. Whereas NAD, sub-Q, or IV, it's immediate response. You do an injection of that stuff, it's bioavailable, you'll have it there. There is not good research showing there's a way to take NAD into the cells. We are very well aware that NAD can't directly move into the cells very well. So what does it have to do? It has to be broken down by CD38 outside the cell into niacin, and then it goes back into the cell. So the argument I always get is, well, you give NAD, inject or IV, it doesn't go into the cell, so it doesn't do anything. Well, anyone that's ever taken NAD sub-Q or IV will say, yeah, I feel something when I do it. 100% feel something. And they'll come afterwards and say, yeah, most of the time they'll say, I feel so much more energy. My brain fog is better. So either every person, large majority is just doing a placebo effect, or it does something. And unfortunately, we don't have enough human data to say what it's doing. We know it can't get into the cell directly, but I would say, personally speaking, I like to use NAD sub-Q every 3 days in practice. 100 milligrams is my dose goal. People will do 50 milligrams, they'll do 80 milligrams. They kind of do a dosing where they feel the best because not everyone can get to 100 milligrams without getting this, like, the chest tightness. The big thing people complain about is heavy chest, out of breath, my heart starts racing a little bit more. That's the most common things we see. Some people get a little nauseous, some people have a tingling down their body. You get that from the IV or from the injection. Either one will still work and have that happen. It's just that the IV, it's continuous. The whole time you get the IV, you feel kind of like garbage. With the injection, it's a shorter lived, maybe a 15 to 20 minute afterwards. The nice thing about the NAD injections is you can keep a steady state much better. So instead of getting an IV every single month, maybe you can get an IV to start, and then you can maintain it with have these steady state injections. So you do injections every few days. And again, anywhere between 10 milligrams and 100 milligrams every 3 days is what I'm recommending for patients. And then I dose up. I slowly start. I start at 20 milligrams. I do 40, 60, 80, 100. Patients move up on their own. And I go, wherever you feel the best, stay there. You don't have to get to 100. It is the goal, but you don't have to. And I do make sure I tell patients, especially if they have methylation issues, if I see some MTHFR changes or their homocysteine's high, or definitely supplement with B vitamins, methylated B vitamins, because it takes a lot of methylation to make NAD work. So you don't want to deplete all the methylation products they have. You want to add some of that in. So I'm very cognizant about saying, hey, you need to be on some methyl products for the NAD to work the best. Not everyone needs it, but a lot of patients have this MTHFR gene mutation. Not active in everyone, like you said, epigenetics, but it is existing. So I do tell
Yeah. What
people,
products do you put them on then? Are you doing some just B12 high dose supplements?
yeah, so we use Homocysteine Supreme by Designs for Health. They have a trimethylglycine in it, methyl B12 and methyl folic acid. I love that product. We do have seen great results with it with patients. I lower my homocysteine. In fact, I had a patient today with a homocysteine of like 12 and my goal is under 7. So then I relaxed lab. She came back 2 months later, homocysteine 7. I'm like, great, it worked. So that'd be a patient I'm like, hey, you before you even touch an AD, you have to be on this. And so this is your guys' question, labs. If you see high homocysteine, which I check for regularly, and you give an AD and they have a high homocysteine, they're going to feel not so great. So again, this person can just take B vitamins and correct it. They don't have to even come see me to do it. But I mean, I do recommend labs because these are things you want to look for. Why do I feel good on NAD? Well, maybe you're a poor methylator. If we fix the methylation issue, your NAD will work better. And I've had patients, that's happened. We put them on methylation products, all of a sudden their NAD works. And like any drug out there, it doesn't work for everyone, right? The thing in peptides we have to understand is they are not magic. It's not that you just take one of these peptides and all of a sudden everything's magic. There are plenty of drugs. They get approved. They work 10% better than placebo, and they're still approved drugs. And we say they have 40% efficacy, but the placebo is 30%. So I do want to remind people that people come to me and say, peptides don't work at all. I did them, they did nothing. Yeah, that's fine. They don't work in everyone. NAD is not going to help every person out there. Not every person needs an NAD. Not every person needs, a testosterone. Not everyone's going to respond to it the same way. That's why we have typically multiple peptides to do healing or multiple peptides to work on energy production, or mitochondria. There's all these different peptides exist, and it's part of the toolbox that we have with providers, is really where we're at with peptide medicine right now.
Well, this has been so fascinating. I think your experience is a lot like ours in California. California is a strict environment too, and I think the more we see people experimenting with peptides on their own without a supervising clinician, then we're eventually going to get problems where someone dies, someone's
For
hospitalized,
sure.
and then the
100%.
government will come in and enforce regulations. So I'm hoping that providers themselves will like really put the word out about the need for baseline testing, the need for 503A or B compounding. And even in the face of compounding, we still don't know what the actual interactions are because, like you said, there's so little research. So hopefully, I
100%.
mean, we are the test generation, but
Yeah.
I think what's it, can we ask what's your personal stack that you're taking or
Oh,
what's your
yeah, of course, of
regimen?
course. Yeah, so I just got back from Rio, from Brazil. I didn't take anything with me. But when I'm normally on my stuff right now, I run testosterone. I am on tirzepatide. I actually switched back to semaglutide recently. I run that at a low dose weekly. I also do take and cycle BP-757. So I'm on BP-757 pretty much all the time. I kind of
You
in
said
frequently
BP
separate
157 or 7?
BP-757. And then I do BP-757. And then I like GHKCU. So I'll cycle GHKCU 8 weeks on and 4 weeks off. That's my baseline. And I like to take clomiphene and HCG are my two ways to raise my testosterone. So I take clomiphene or HCG. Some supplements I'm on, like magnesium and stuff, but supplement peptide wise, it's just really my growth hormone peptide, my GLP-1, and then something to raise my testosterone and then something for repair. Because I feel like that's kind of like the overall stack that I feel most efficient. And I'll cycle things. I'll cycle through Epitalon during the year. I'll cycle through MOTC through the year, SS31. I'll cycle all of these. But what my core stack is kind of these four things at all times, unless I'm cycling off them for a month or so.
Yeah, I think that's what you'll find with most people who are experienced with their peptides too. Like many of my friends, we travel and lecture a lot, and nobody takes their stuff on trips because it's
No.
just too hard to. And it's
No.
also, I feel that the body needs some periods of reset where
Exactly.
it has nothing, where it goes back to its original stress and cycles and home, hormesis state. So I think that's super important to do intermittent cycling and to figure out your
Course.
body patterns and also just to
Yeah.
look seasonally at like is it winter or is it summer, like your body responds circadianly too. So
100%.
well, this is so fascinating. Jason, where can people find you if they want to check out your practice or get more information?
Yeah. So I'm at Dr. Dr. Period Jason Pensick on Instagram. I have a TikTok, which I don't use, which is Dr. Thirst Trap. A patient of mine made that years ago. I thought it was really funny. And
That's
I
a
was like,
good
I'll take
title.
it. It's a good title. So I put it up and I think I have probably 10 videos. I need to get back on that. I'm working on some long form podcasts right now, but we haven't had that up yet. And I'm working on some like layperson education right now to help people, in general who just don't know peptides, get a general idea of what these do and how they work, so they don't feel lost in the woods and go to some random person online, their favorite Pilates instructor or stewardess, start selling them peptides and tell us what they do. So right now, just with my Instagram is kind of what I use.
Perfect. Well, that's it for now, guys. Don't forget to find me on my Instagram. It's Beauty by Dr. K, DRKAY. And our website is the same, beautybydrk.com. And you'll find me lecturing at conferences all around. This year, we're doing a biohacking beauty session at AmSpa coming up in April. If you are interested in aesthetics and you want to learn more, this is a great opportunity. Thank you for coming on, Jason. I hope you come visit if you're next time you're in LA.
Okay, Doc. Thank you so much.
Love you guys. Stay beautiful.